Log Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here at Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. Today we have 2 hours for you coming up. Four great authors on top. First, we're going to have Gail Lukasik, then Mary Jones, Leigh Hammett, and James Tabor all on the bill this morning here for Suspense Radio, or the afternoon, whenever you're listening. So let's stop wasting time and stop hearing me talk, and let's get through this thing, because 2 hours of Suspense Radio begins right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Everybody, I want to thank you for joining us here on this Saturday morning of Suspense Radio. One quick shout out, of course, I do want to say this is the first time we've been on since the Boston Marathon bombings. I do want to say, you know, our condolences to everyone who was injured, the three fatalities and possibly more. Very happy that they have caught one of the suspects. The other one has been killed, so it looks like, you know, things are going in the right direction. So again, you know, just want to say, thank you for everyone, and everything that's going on out there. It's a very trying time. We do have a lot of fans. We have a lot of authors that we know around the Boston area, New England area, and that's affecting everyone. Can we just stop the insanity, though, people? Thank you. So I want to go right now to our first guest, award-winning author Gail Lukasik. The book is called The Lost Artist. And, Gail, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I am doing great, and thank you, John, for inviting me to be on your show and giving me an opportunity to talk about The Lost Artist.
Yeah, and from your website, which is GailLukasik.com, and your last name is spelled L-U-K-A-S-I-K, you mentioned, of course, that The Lost Artist is, you know, a debut standalone mystery. So give us a little bit about the book and, you know, why, you know, now you decided to kind of go with standalone mystery and a little bit of thought behind it.
Okay, I'd love to. The Lost Artist is about the quest for one of the greatest lost art treasures of 16th century America. And the secret to finding this lost art treasure is hidden in these four mysterious murals, which are in an old southern Illinois farmhouse that was built in the 19th century. And my protagonist is Rose Caffrey, and she is a Chicago performance artist. And she inherits the old farmhouse when her sister Karen dies in this mysterious fall inside the house. And once she discovers these murals, she becomes obsessed with them. She wants to know who the identity of the artist is, and she wants to know what these murals mean. She's really obsessed with them. They have these kind of strange images of Native Americans and these incongruent 19th century landscapes. So her quest, as she pursues this and tries to figure it out, she ends up unearthing crimes and secrets going back over 400 years.
You know, and obsession, of course, is one of the great things within suspense mystery thriller. You got to have a character that obsesses about something. And when you start diving into it, now I'm going to say, is part of this like historical fact? Is some of this, was all of this fiction kind of made up? Was there a kind of was there an outlining historical story that you kind of pulled the basis from to put together this book?
I'm glad you asked that, because the majority of the history in the book is factual. And what got me started, it's a weird thing. This friend of mine handed me this article about 3 years ago, I think it was, and it was about, this group of Florida marine archaeologists who were searching for a French fleet that sank off the coast of Florida in 1565 during a hurricane. So, and I'm kind of fat. I'm obsessed myself a little bit about archaeology and lost civilizations and all that. So I started doing research, and I found out. I found out this French fleet was tied to France's second failed attempt to establish a permanent colony in Florida around Jacksonville. And you know what? The funny thing is, if they had not, if they had been successful, and if the Spanish hadn't destroyed the fort and massacred almost everyone there, this colony predated Jamestown. So but of course it didn't happen. So I dug deeper into this, and I found out that associated with this fort and the colonization was a European artist, our first European artist in America, by the name of Jacques Lemoyne. And of course, it's one of his drawings that is what this quest is about.
So then, when you start deciding, hey, you know what, I want to do a mystery book and I want to do something a little off the beaten path, you have the idea, you kind of got this idea of this is what you wanted to explore. Now you're going to have to go across and you're going to have to pick the correct characters in order to play, in your sandbox. So what made Rose Caffrey kind of stick out in your mind as the person that would be the correct person to star in the book here, The Lost Artist?
Well, I really had a hard time nailing down who the present day protagonist was going to be. I kept thinking, well, she'd be a photographer, and I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I wanted something a little edgier. So that's why I chose a performance artist. And she's a struggling performance artist. She's not particularly successful. So I wanted her to be rebellious. I wanted her to be edgy. And I wanted her to be very, very curious, the kind of person who would be persistent in, pursuing this very difficult task that's going to be ahead of her to find this lost art treasure. And she has to be able to interpret, right, the murals. So she had to be an artist of some sort.
And so then when you're starting to do a lot of the research behind and the historical aspects of it, did you find yourself discovering some things that, kind of surprised you and, things that maybe you had to switch gears a little bit when you decided, that you were going to write and maybe you had one direction to go and then all of a sudden you find out, oh, wait a second, I'm going to go this way instead. I mean, so do those things always creep into your head?
Yeah, my biggest task on this was I had this huge leap in time. I had to go from 1565 to present day. So how do you do that? And where has this lost art treasure been in all that time? And who has it? And how do these murals tie into it? So that was a huge task for me. And that's why I ended up setting the farmhouse in southern Illinois, because I discovered in my research that I'm sure you're familiar with the Trail of Tears, which, that happened in 1836, 1838, around that time. where the U.S. government relocated all the Cherokee. So I found out, and I live in Illinois, but I, you know, I'm not from Illinois, but so I didn't know that the northern route that the Cherokee took came through southern Illinois. So that was news to me. And not only did the Cherokee come through southern Illinois, but it was a particularly difficult winter. So they became trapped for several months between the Ohio River and the Mississippi River. And a lot of them died in Illinois during that time because of the harsh conditions. So this house that I put in the book is connected to the Trail of Tears and to the Cherokee as well. I hope that's making sense.
So basically, I mean, so you have kind of a couple things kind of wrapped up all within, starting back in 1565, you kind of got murals, but now you're kind of incorporating the history of the area into the southern Illinois part. So you have a lot of layers that are kind of going along with it. So what was like one of your most difficult parts when you're kind of piecing all those puzzle pieces together and you're trying to make them all fit? What struggles did you have when you started writing to kind of make sure that they were all going to kind of fit in the right direction?
Well, I think the biggest struggle was I had so much research. I had done so much research, way more than I needed for the book. So it was, all right, what am I going to use? And
Almost like overstudying for a test.
Absolutely.
You kind of overstudied, yeah.
I overstudied. I did too much work. I worked too hard.
Right.
And actually, the original manuscript had another section in it that was set in 1565 at Fort Caroline. And I usually have, three people that read my manuscript before I send it off to the publisher. And one of my readers said to me, you know, I think you should take it out. It's too much. So, again, I had too much. So I did take that section out, and I realized, she's right, I really don't need it because I can do the same thing. I can give that same kind of information with the present-day characters. I didn't need to go back to 1565. So, it really was like putting together this huge quilt. You know, you have all these little swatches, but how, you know, doing the time, getting the time to work, and then there's also a 19th century section that I had to weave into there with the Emily Lord Braun section. She's another artist that was the original owner of that farmhouse. So, you know, that was difficult as well to make it work. And keep the, you know, make
the
pages
turn.
And, you
know, fans of yours that were already involved in your Lee Gerard series, because Death Door was your second book in that series, Destroying Angels was your first.
Right.
When they kind of, when maybe they email you or ask you, you know, your next book is coming out, and maybe they're a little upset that it's not another, you know, Lee Gerard book, what do you kind of tell them about The Lost Artist? What's the one thing after they read it, or maybe before you, you know, that you kind of let them know, or questions that they may ask you? How is it kind of different from your previous work?
Okay. I am asked that, and let me put it this way. As soon as I finished The Lost Artist, I already had 100 pages written of the next book, the third book in the Lee Gerard series. So
yeah.
I tell them that's coming out soon, and it is coming out actually this September. So I did these books back-to-back. So I tell them that.
Okay.
And then I tell them, look, I need a little break. And I want to try something different, and I want to come back to the third book in the series refreshed and ready to go. So, you know, I'm an artist, and we need breaks.
Yeah. And sort of, you know, but the style of the book, not just really the characters, do you think that maybe you kind of have a different style? Is there a different voice? Is it a different edginess, more of one maybe emotion than another? That when your fans do, you know, read it, they'll be like, oh, you know, I mean, because now they're just starting, you know, instead of the character, they're starting to really get into you as an author because of, you know, you kind of changing things up a little bit on them.
I am. And what I can say to that is Rose, though she is not Lee is, I think, is a more, I don't know, she's edgy, but she's also sarcastic, and, you know, she's funny in her own way. Whereas Rose has a whole other history behind her that she's not quite as she's not sarcastic at all. She's suffering a loss because she's lost her sister at the very beginning of the book, and she's on a different journey. But
right.
as far as my writing, I think my writing is probably, the style is pretty similar. I'm just dealing with different people and a different plot. Does that help?
Yeah, I just know, you know, of course, you know, fans are very fickle. And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Gail Lukasik, author of the book, The Lost Artist, which is her latest here. And it's out now, so you can go to gaillukasik.com to find out more information. But, you know, fans are very fickle, and they'll email you about the littlest thing. I mean, you just never know. You know, we had a nice discussion on our last show. I'm trying to remember, I forget who the guest was. We were talking about it, but they said, you know, you can kill men, you know, you can kill women, you know, you want to kind of stay away from children and things, but if you kill a dog or a cat, fans are going to go ballistic and they're going to email you like crazy. So there's certain
that's
things
true.
That you can't touch, and you kind
yeah.
of find these out when you're weaving yourself through, and that's just funny.
Right. Yeah, and you know what? That's the great thing about hanging out with other mystery authors, because they tell you that.
they give you the heads up.
Yeah. And I've been on a lot of panels and gone to a gazillion conferences, and I already know I don't dare kill any animals.
Yeah.
I would never do that anyway because I love animals so much, but,
right.
you know. But, yeah, there's some no-nos that you don't want to do. But I think if, you know, if your fans like what you're doing, I think they'll stick with you and read books.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I do. I mean, I read a lot, and if I see an author doing a standalone, I'm curious. I want to see what they're doing, you know, what's happening, how they're doing it. So I think it's all good.
Right, and I think that authors like yourself, you know, when you start writing a series, you always want to challenge yourself, and you want to see, you want to kind of get out of that one zone, and you want to kind of create something else from scratch, because it's very exciting to kind of start with that blank canvas again instead of already having a background and trying to recreate. And is that kind of what it was like for you? You're like, oh, my God,
yeah.
now I'm starting in front of a white canvas again, and I got nothing. Now I got to redo
yeah.
it all over again.
Yeah, it totally was like that. I wanted to challenge myself. You know, I started my writing career as a poet, and I was a poet for a long, long time, and I was a published poet. So, you know, when you're writing poetry, it's very, very different than writing mystery fiction, because writing poetry, you're waiting for the muse often, and if the muse is there, great, and if it's not, well, okay, then you do something else. I find miswriting fiction is more like a job. You know, I want to be at that computer at 9 in the morning, and I want to put my, you know, 3 hours in, and if it's a bad day, I still put the 3 hours in, and if it's a good day, maybe I'll put more hours in. So
right.
I think that's, you know, and to do another, a new project is kind of like getting back into my poetic roots, that excitement, you know, of
you
I
know,
never
and,
know where something's
yeah.
coming.
Right, you just never know. And, you know, and I also notice here that on May 22nd, you're doing a writing Nature's Way workshop. That is in Elgin, Illinois. For anybody, I don't know if I have any fan, how many people are listening in Elgin, Illinois. It's the Gail Borden Public Library in Elgin. But now, when you're doing a workshop, like, what does this workshop kind of entail? You know, what do you kind of focus on that you like to kind of relay to other authors? Because you are successful, you are, you know, you have done this, you know, and this is kind of your life. What's kind of the things that you like to relay to them when you're in these, involved in these workshops?
Well, when I'm doing, if you'd like me to, I'll talk specifically about the nature writing, because I do
yeah,
many
absolutely.
Different kinds. But for the nature writing, what's great about that workshop is it's open to any level of writer. Doesn't matter if you've never written anything or you've been writing for years. Because we do journal exercises. They're very specific, but they're all nature-based. And what happens is, even if you're blocked and you think, oh, I can't write, you know, something's going on, the journaling opens you up because you're not thinking like that. You're thinking about whatever I'm telling you to observe in the natural world or whatever the exercise is, and it's very freeing. It's very freeing, and we do a lot of free writes, which means You know, free rights are, I've given you 10 minutes. You don't worry about spelling. You don't worry about grammar. I give you a prompt. For example, a prompt would be spring is or spring is like, and then you just write for 10 minutes about spring. And it's very interesting to see what people come up with. They surprise themselves. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they're able to kind of channel a little bit and get themselves and really use their imagination and really start thinking about how the words should kind of act on the page, I guess you want to say.
Yeah, you know, it's a way to get the critic off your back, because so many writers, even beginning writers, have the critic on their back thinking, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that, and it shuts you down. You really don't want to do that. So, you know, journaling and nature writing exercises is a way, you know, when if you're going to go play tennis or something, don't you have to warm up? So it's a, you're flexing a different muscle, you know? You got to get the muscles going. Yeah.
And, you know, and that's kind of like the same thing because, you know, with the publishing and everything is so fast-paced and so, I mean, it changes from day to day.
Are
like the things that, you know, what are the things that you do just as an author to keep yourself kind of ahead of the game to be able to, you know, not only with your writing, but I always tell people just because you write the end in the book, you're simply at the beginning stage. You've done the easy part. Now the hard part is getting people to find the book, read the book, I mean, and keep going with you. So kind of how have you been able to kind of meander through this weirdness that we got going on right now?
Okay. First of all, I have a really stable, good publisher. It's five-star Gale Cengage. They do a lot of different kinds of books, including textbooks. So I have a really good publisher. So we work hand-in-hand. You know, it's getting the arcs out to reviewers because you want to be reviewed by one of the big fours, and if you get a good review, you know, librarians look at that, they'll order your book. I don't know how much readers look at that, but I know librarians do look at that. So that's one thing. So that's like the first step. And I work with a publicist, and she tries to get me, you know, just like we're doing today, radio interview. I go out, and I'll go anywhere. I'll go to book groups. I'll go to libraries and give talks. I'll give workshops. I just did a workshop at a high school for their arts festival on poetry. So it's all good. And you just got to get yourself out there. And I do stuff online, you know, Facebook and that kind of thing. And I'm on Goodreads and LinkedIn and all of those sites that I can put announcements up.
Yeah. I mean, just everyone's got to try to find, you know, kind of like you got to find like your little piece of the canvas to kind of put your little signature on. I mean, that's kind of what we've, you know, come down because there's so many authors that are coming out now, and it's just difficult for readers. Even though there is so much out there, there's almost so much that it's so difficult for them to find. So that's kind of why,
you know,
it's great to be able to have authors on like this. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very difficult to find, and so many people are self-publishing. So how do you make decisions as a reader what you're going to read? How do you decide? I mean, even myself, I have to make decisions as a reader who I'm going to read. So I do pay attention to reviews and things like that, you know, who's doing what. And also joining organizations like Sisters in Crime and going to conferences is another great thing you can do.
Right. Well, you know what? Tell us here what kind of sentence or, you know, what paragraph do you feel within the book kind of captures the essence of the lost artist?
Wow. That is, you got me on that one. I love my opening sentence, and I'm going to read my opening sentence, and actually, my book was chosen for, I think, Hook from the First Page, which is a site that it's just a listing of, I guess, the blogger thinks are really good books. And it took me a while. I didn't come up with this first sentence till after I'd written the whole book.
Okay.
And the first sentence reads, "The empty grave changed everything."
And there you have it.
And there you have it.
And that's the perfect kind of prelude into a book. I mean, and that's kind of the way that you want to view it. So when you see that first sentence, it's much different than it used to be, where the, you know, it was a dark and stormy night and the ship rocked and rolled.
But that to me says a lot.
That's the one.
About how this book, how it moves, and how it's pretty, the pacing's pretty vigorous, and it really does move. It's a page-turner type, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, Gail, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been fascinating to speak with you, author Gail Lukasik, and the book is The Lost Artist. So keep in touch with us. Let us know what's going on, and, you know, we will speak some other time down the road.
Oh, that would be great. I just want to say one thing. The Lost Artist just came out on Kindle. So it's available on Kindle, and Amazon, in their wonderful wisdom, is discounting it.
Oh, there we go. You always like
there
the discount.
There we go. Yes, I love the discount.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so John. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. You have a good day, and we'll speak with you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Gail Lukasik. The book is called The Lost Artist, very historical in nature, wrapped within a great mystery suspense, and that's exactly the way that, you know, fans like yourself love to read those things. I will say that, of course, you know, the magazine is coming out shortly for May. April has been out now. And there's a lot from the editor, because Gail said something that was very interesting in that interview, where you want to be reviewed by the Big Four. Well, I've done a little bit of research on that, and I put it in the letter from the editor, and it will be in May. But I will just say, readers, beware of reviews. And that's what I'm going to say. That's my tick for the magazine, and you can read the editor. You might find it a little bit you can almost say disturbing. But you know what? That's the world we live in nowadays, and we are going to be back here with our next guest. And in the meantime, don't cry.
Hard times you have.
back, everybody, here to Suspense Radio and our first little half-hour break that we just had. We want to thank author Gail Lukasik for coming on the show to talk about her book, The Lost Artist. But now we're going to be switching gears here, and we're going to bring on our next guest. She is author Mary Jones. She's best known here for her Harper Jennings thriller series, but she's done a standalone. She has a new character named Ellie Harrison, and she's put her into her own book called The Trouble with Charlie. So we want to thank Mary so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks. How are you?
So again, I'm doing fabulous. So again, I said, The Trouble with Charlie here, brand new character, Ellie Harrison, a little bit different from your normal series that fans might know you from Harper Jennings. So give us a little bit about, The Trouble with Charlie and Ellie and kind of why you decided to take the break and why you felt that, Ellie was the character to go into the book, The Trouble with Charlie.
I had so much fun writing this book. Actually, I wrote it before I wrote the Harper Jennings first book, but it was sitting around at my agent because it crosses genres. It's not a traditional thriller or suspense novel. It crosses a little bit into the supernatural, and my agent wasn't real sure what to do with it for a while. So, we kept it around, but I really had such a good time writing it. I call her Elle, you call her Ellie, it doesn't matter, she's the same person. Elle is a second grade teacher. She's about to get divorced from Charlie, and she comes home after one of her first nights out with a friend because she hasn't been going out because she's been depressed. She goes out, she comes home, and she finds, ta-dum, Charlie on their sofa, dead, stabbed with her kitchen knife.
Ooh.
Now, okay, that's a setup for a mystery novel, right? Except, yeah. And, of course, she's going to be the suspect because it's in her house. It's her kitchen knife. It's her soon-to-be ex-husband, so it all fingers point to her. The thing is that in order to prove her innocence, she starts doing some investigating, and she finds out that Charlie's had a secret life and all of that. But not only that, she starts to think that Charlie is still around and that he blames her for his death. So the question comes out through the novel, is Charlie really there? Is he haunting her? And who was Charlie? And how bad was Charlie? And how bad were the things he was into? And how much danger is Elle in now that she's finding out about his associates? They're coming after her. And if Charlie's angry at her, is she in danger from him? Or is he a figment of her imagination? So we're crossing into a little bit of psychological questions. What's real? What's imagined? And is the scarier danger come from real, concrete, physical, living, breathing bad guys? Or does it come from a ghost named Charlie? Or does it come from Elle's own mind? Like, does she not know what's real versus what's imagined? And is that her biggest danger? So I had so much fun writing it and posing these questions about reality and imagination and what's known and what's unknown, that I think it's a really fun quandary. And I like that shadowy part of not really knowing what's real, what's in someone's mind and what's real. I find that scary and fun.
Right. You're able to kind of search your own, whether it's subconscious mind or, deep down into your subconscious mind, in order to kind of figure out, is the mind kind of playing tricks or are things really happening and you're just not able to process them? And how would somebody, like your character Elle Harrison, how would she be able to put herself into a situation like that? And you always got to do it personally to kind of figure out, how a reaction like that would come about a normal person.
I don't think it's that far of a stretch. A lot of people who lose someone really close to them have an experience for a while of still hearing that person's voice, or do they? or imagining them in the room, or do they? I mean, it's like you're missing them so much, you're so used to hearing them and seeing them, that is your mind playing tricks with it, with you? And so if we've had little experiences like that, and many of us have, then you can take a step further and say, well, if I felt guilty, or if I thought this person were really mad at me, would I then think that they were there to settle the score? And, you know, you can just go a step further. It's not that big of a leap, I don't think.
No, I don't think it's that big of a leap either, but I always kind of find it fascinating that when you start putting in the psychological aspects into suspense and thriller, I always love to see how the author is going to do, because there's so many different twists and turns that you can play with that, that it can make for a very interesting read. But it can also be very convoluted, so you kind of have to watch yourself as an author that you write, that you're not really going too far and still keeping it into the good realm of, you know, into the reality part, and not really making it go way off base.
That's right. Because basically what you're writing is a thriller, and you want that suspense, and you want that believability. You know, I'm not writing in the horror genre. I'm not writing in the monster.
Right.
Yeah, so it does. It's grounded in reality. And the relationships amongst the characters ground L as well. I mean, she has very strong women friends, and she has a career, and she has, and at the same time that she's dealing with all these major questions, she's grounded in reality in the sense that she has to plan a funeral and pick out what he's going to wear when she buries him, and deal with the mundane. The mundane details, and seeing his sister and her in-laws and her former mother-in-law who's battling dementia, and so there's comic relief throughout the book. I mean, there's some very, I tried to keep it funny at the same time.
Right.
I didn't want it to get too dark and too serious. I want it to be a fun book, and I have fun writing it, so I think people will have fun reading it. The trouble with Charlie is maybe the most fun book I've ever written.
The funny thing is you wrote that before your other book, so you kind of had that comedy in you from the beginning, and so then when you pulled it out again, did you kind of have to do some rewrites and update it? Because I don't know how old it was, if it was 5, 6, 7 years old. Did you have to kind of do some updates, rewrite the things, and make it maybe set them in maybe more today's times, or incorporate things that happened current event-wise? Did you do any of that?
No, but you know what? It wasn't that old. It was a couple of years, and it wasn't that old.
Years. Okay.
And I don't think it's a modern book, but it isn't set in, I mean, current events didn't play a role. It's set in Philadelphia, which is where I live. But, no, I didn't have to do that. It seasoned itself. I think the time was better for it when it came out than it would have been had she tried to place it earlier. Sometimes there is a marketing thing. It's something intangible about or at least from a writer's point of view, it's intangible about when a book is marketable and when it isn't quite marketable, when it has its time, when a publisher is going to look at it and when they won't, what's in fashion. I don't quite understand it.
and then you have the publishers that are like, you know, it's going to be so good that somebody has to start the fad. I mean, that's the thing. You know, someone had to write the first vampire book. Someone had to write the first zombie book. And they had to be able to publish it to send it out there. So somebody has to kind of jump it out there and get the ball rolling with some of this. But the good thing about, you know, ghost stories and things of that, they're always so timeless, and they just never get old. And it's just so wonderful to be able to read these things. And, you know, that's why, you know, when you're writing the book, the one thing that I always find interesting and when I'm sitting here and I'm kind of thinking in my head, you've started off Charlie dead. So now people have to know him as a dead person because they can't experience his emotions. They can't hear him speak. So it has to go through the eyes of Elle and the things
exactly.
around. So she has to basically, so Elle has the job of introducing herself and Charlie to the fans. That had to be very tricky when you were writing that.
You know what? I wasn't thinking of it that way. If I thought of it that way, it would have been tricky. But I was really writing her experience because it's told from her point of view. It's first person. So
okay.
I didn't have to create his thoughts and his persona. What I did was use her friends as foils, and when they're consoling her, backstory comes up about what he has done to her, or why they're getting divorced, or why she's angry at him, or what she feels bad about, what's unresolved in their relationship, that, you know, despite their getting divorced, she still has feelings for him. So I didn't really need to present him as a finished character, except as she perceives him and what she hears or imagines him saying to her, because that's what's relevant to the story. If I had, as I said, if I had thought about it that way, I might have gotten all tongue-tied and said, but
you
I
know.
Would,
it's easy to look at after the fact now. You know, it's kind of easy to look at after the fact. But it is, I mean, because you've got to kind of wrap that stuff up because one of the main characters is dead at the very beginning of the book, and that's got to be a little difficult.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. You're right, and I'm glad I didn't think of it that way. but he isn't dead. I mean, he's dead, but he lives on through the ongoing investigation and the people. You know, it's like that. When you think about a person who's gone, what lives on? And what do we maintain? What do we retain from that person? It's our memories. It's sometimes issues we haven't resolved with them. It's the good times, the bad times, the different feelings we've had for them. And so that's what haunts her. If she personifies that, that's one possibility. Or is he actually there haunting her is another interpretation.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Mary Jones, maryjones.com. That's M-E-R-R-Y, jones.com. The book is The Trouble with Charlie. And so, like we had our last guest on, you know, someone who had written a series and then jumped out to write a standalone book, you know, I always kind of ask the question, when your fans found out that your next book that was being written, and even though they only have to wait until July for the next Harper Jennings thriller, how were they kind of, you know, perceived as like, oh, why are you doing this? And, you know, and how did you maybe have to try to sell them on it? And then after they read it, kind of what was their reaction? And, you know, they were like, oh, okay, I gotcha, da-da-da, you know, those kinds of things.
You know, I haven't had a break in the Harper Jennings series since it started. It's been every 6 months, which is a pretty tight schedule. So I don't know that readers of Harper Jennings have been thinking, like, why are you doing something else? Because there's always a new one. It hasn't slowed down. Winter Break just came out in January. The next one's out in July. The thing is that what's so different is that the characters are different, the natures of the mystery. Harper Jennings is a pretty straightforward thriller. Except that, I don't know that I think about it. Or here's a run-on sentence for you. She, like Elle, has reality issues. She has post-traumatic stress. Elle has got her issues with reality and imagination. And Harper, having been an Iraq war veteran, came back from Iraq with post-traumatic stress and disorder, and she has flashbacks, so that when she's in danger or stressed, she also has trouble distinguishing what's real from what she's perceiving, but is the result of a flashback. So there is a similarity there, and maybe the readers of one were drawn to Harper because of her complexity. They might also like Al because of hers, and the relationship between real danger and perceived danger, which mm-hmm. overlap.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of when you're writing and you're trying to and you're writing something new, you always kind of have a little bit of pull in from your last thing. I think that's just human nature. And so, some of your characters might resemble characters that you had in previous books, but they all have their own voice. They all have their own separate. You know, they all got issues. I mean, that's why you're writing about them, because they all got issues. Let's face it. You know, they ain't perfect, and that's the whole point. We don't want perfect characters. We need characters that have issues. That's to make them fun.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And so, but you know, when people go on your website, too, they're going to notice that you have a lot more, you know, than just... you know, Harper Jennings, and then just this new book, The Trouble with Charlie, because you had another series that was out, and Zoe Hayes, you know,
right.
You have a lot of other things. What kind of got you, what was kind of the pull to say that, you know, mysteries is the field and kind of the pool that I want to play in?
Well, you know, it's I could give you one of like six answers for that, but for one thing, I think that for me, any story is suspense. It's in the telling of the story, in the perception of a story. But for me, life is suspense. It's like, what's going to happen? What's the next shoe that's going to drop? Where is the next...
Right.
Yeah. And I think whether we're aware of it or not, that's how we all do, because we know nobody, you know, something's going to happen sooner or later, and some of us are more watchful than others. I feel
look what just happened in Boston. Who would have predicted
exactly,
that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and watching that play out, it was, it was mortifying, and the suspense was over the top, and from beginning to end, we were all so wrapped up in it, but I think of suspense novels as not metaphors, but they're like a means for which us for people to go through vicariously the strain and stress and fear and suspense of life, and then mm-hmm. come out at the end. So I think that's why they appeal. Why it appealed to me particularly was at one point my husband was really, really ill. He had a terrible kind of cancer that nobody lives through. Thank God he did. But at the time, the odds were, they said, don't go online. Don't look it up. You don't want to know about this. Just, you know, each case is different. So we thought his life was on the line, and I felt horribly helpless. I couldn't imagine... I can't even articulate how helpless I felt. So I would sit in his room, and he would say, you're staring at me. I can't sleep. I can't anything. Go home. Stop staring at me. Go write a book. And so go home and write a book. So I went home, and I started writing mysteries. And I realized in hindsight that before that I'd been doing nonfiction and humor. Now I was writing mysteries. Why? In hindsight, I can tell you, because here I had control. Here I had a bad guy come in. I had horribly unexpected evil things happening, and I could control them. I could overcome the danger. I could survive. I could see who lived, who died, I could punish the evil thing. And so I made a bad guy out of cancer. I made the male character, it's interesting, he was scarred. And, you know, at the time, I swear, John, I did not consciously make him scarred.
Wow.
But he was scarred. And now I know it was because my husband was scarred, and I was, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of other, you know, similarities, except they were both, you know, undoubtedly handsome and wonderful in all ways. But
right.
No, I'm just saying that. But it was, for me, a way of reining in life and saying, okay, life is scary, life is unpredictable, you never know what's going to hit you, but I can take it and I can mold it. And in this arena, at least in this arena, I can be in charge. Thank God my husband recovered. It's been, I don't know, 10 years or maybe, he's been healthy for some number of years now. But that's how, for me, it turned, my writing turned to suspense. Long answer to a short question.
Yeah, but see, but that's the part that fans and I guess and even struggling authors need to know, that you tapped into something for yourself to put on the page and to get yourself going, because it wasn't a fake emotion. It wasn't anything you had to make up. It wasn't a place that you had to put yourself. You were already there. So all the emotions and all the feelings that you brought out were all real. And that's what a new author, someone trying to break in, needs to understand. You have to put yourself into precarious and, you know, very unsettling situations in order to bring out those emotions that work on the page. And then that's when the editors and the publishers of the book say, wow, this book is fabulous. And it was just your straight emotions that kind of came out. And that's the separation from a great author to somebody who can just put words on a page, two totally separate things.
Well, I think we can all pull out terror. We've all had, you know, it's part of life. And that
right,
might have been...
We can all pull it out, but they don't all do it. And that's the thing that they need to understand. They need to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And relive those horrors that you were reliving through your husband, that you had to see every day, that's not the place that you wanted to be, but you used it to an advantage, I guess, just to put yourself in a good place.
Well, you know, and that's contrary. Let's just make it clear, though. This was not it wasn't the same as just purging your emotions on paper. You do have to be very much in control of it,
yeah.
and make sure that you're using it appropriately in the story. Yeah,
right.
I mean, but to be able to tap into that emotion and use it, that is important. And I don't want anyone to think that if you're talking to new writers, you don't have to have a loved one in danger. You had nightmares
when
you were a little kid, or you were afraid of the boogeyman, or you almost got hit by a car one day or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I still think that there's a monster under my bed. I'm telling you right now.
Well, you know what?
Maybe that's because I read too many thriller books that I still think there's a monster under my bed.
We might all have one under our bed or somewhere in the closet, like in Family Guy, that
really?
Monkey.
But no one believes me. No one believes me. There's a monster under my bed, and they all just think I'm crazy. They're like, you're 42. There's no monster. I'm like, yeah, he just hasn't left me.
It's actually sweet. You have a roommate.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. Well, Mary, I wanted to do this. So, you know, kind of let us know and let, you know, kind of like end, because we're kind of running up here. We have about a minute to go.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, The Trouble with Charlie, and again, everybody, the website is maryjones.com, M-E-R-R-Y. Give us kind of that one kind of scene or maybe that one kind of character, something that kind of stands out to you that kind of captures like the essence of the book, so people will kind of get the understanding of this is kind of what you, when you get into it, this is kind of what it's all going to wrap up to be. You don't have to give anything away unless you want to.
I think it's a story about a relationship from the point of view of the woman who survived it. It's a love story with a dead man. It's a love story with a bad man. It's complicated, but it's also fun and humorous. so I just, and people who read it tell me they've had a good time. They can't put it down. They sit up all night with it. So just enjoy. If you read it, just enjoy it and let me know. Also, Winter Break is the last one of the Harper books. Let me know if you like that, too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes. Well, Mary, I tell you what. I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been fascinating to hear the story and then the stories behind the stories like you just told. Those are the kind of the things that, you know, really, you know, intrigued me also to kind of hear all those stories behind the stories, like I said. So I want to thank you so much for coming and talking about your latest book, The Trouble with Charlie, and everything else you have going on. Again, you know, keep in touch. Let us know what's happening, and maybe we'll speak sometime in the future, and we'll catch up at Thriller Fest. We'll be out there in July.
Thank you. It's good to see you. I mean, good to talk to you.
Right.
Radio.
This is the way people see each other in today's day and age anyway. So, you know, this is the way it works.
Right. Take care, John.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mary. Have a good one. Bye.
You too. Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Mary Jones, maryjones.com, M-E-R-R-Y, and the book is The Trouble with Charlie, so you can check that out now. We're going to take here our halfway point break, and we're going to be back with our next guest. His name is Lane Haymont, or Haymont. I know, hopefully they'll correct me because, you know, I always screw it up. But in the meantime, again, we'll be back on in, you know, four minutes, whatever, you know the deal.
I can feel no sense of measure, no illusion as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we make real.
Downtown, giving away, but she never came back. No phone, take your place, you know what I mean. We have the same intrigue, the daughter came. We'll be right back.
want to welcome everybody back here for our second hour of the show. We have a little technical things with the music. I can't really fade it down like I like to do and to be able to kind of have a fade down, so I got to kind of stop it abruptly. And that kind of messes up my flow. It kind of doesn't do exactly what I want it to do. But that's okay. I know that just having a little things on the studio and stuff like that, but it happens, and that's what you get when you get live radio. Things just are a little bit interesting. So we're going to jump right in here to our next guest. He is author Lane Haymont, and his book is called The Freedman and the Pharaoh's Staff. It's lanehaymont.com, H-E-Y-M-O-N-T. So, Lane, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing fabulous. Thank you again. And, you know, we got a hold of the book, and, you know, we were kind of introduced to it. I forget who kind of emailed me or kind of how, and then I started diving into it a little bit, and it was very interesting, and I loved the subject line. And so I wanted you to go ahead and tell somebody a little bit about the book, Freedman and the Pharaoh's Staff, because it's a, you know, you said it right. You're saying it's a historical novel set in the Reconstruction era of Louisiana, which was an extremely volatile time in the nation's history at that time. And to be able to put a book together, you kind of had to do a lot of work with it.
Yes, I did a lot of research. There was so much going on just in Louisiana, where the Klan, the government, waged basically a terrorist war on the Klan and arrested them, tried to wipe them off the planet, and the Klan fled to Louisiana because, you know, it was one of the deepest cut states in the South, and that's where I got the idea of it, where the Klan is trying to regroup. They're hiding out in Louisiana, and they're trying to rise up again and take down the northern government.
But what you kind of have in there is you're also pulling in a lot of, you know, when you say Pharaoh's Staff, you're going to start pulling in some Egyptian history. So kind of how does the correlation, you know, of that era with the Klan, you know, with all the uncertainty and everything else, you know, comes up again, and then you throw Egyptian stuff into it. How does all that kind of stuff work together?
I connected a whole bunch of different time periods because I thought, you know, all human beings, you know, evolution, we all came from Africa, from, you know, Egypt and Africa, so we're all the same, and I thought that would be a great correlation or metaphor that we're all the same and Africa is where we all came from. So that's how I got to the Egyptian idea. And the pharaohs, they were considered gods. And I thought we all came from the same place.
Right. I mean, and did you have to pull... And what kind of, you know, what kind of historical, factual things did you kind of have to pull in, you know, when you started doing a lot of the research, that you felt, you know, wow, this is, I can see the tie between 1871 America and kind of Egypt. You know, how was that kind of working out into your head when you started doing it?
It was really difficult, and I chose the first, because the first king of Egypt that we know about was the Scorpion King, and we really know nothing about him. And then there was Narmer, which is the Pharaoh's Staff, and I decided to go with that because it is the first king of Egypt. And for me, the Civil War, winning the Civil War was the first, it was a turning tide in America where we said we are going to live by freedom. I mean, we had the Constitution, but I mean, the Constitution was, it was primitive. We still allowed slaves. We didn't have, you know, women couldn't vote. It was still this very primitive, unenlightened piece of literature that didn't really, it freed white men, but it didn't free very many other people.
Mm-hmm. So and when you're writing, Yeah, and when you started to, one of the barriers that people have, and are whenever you're writing about a subject matter and you include, like a Hitler, or you include like the Ku Klux Klan, you include those types of subjects and those types of people or organizations that, of course, people over time have found to be extremely evil in nature and things like that. How are you kind of, able to kind of put all that together, but not let, when you're writing about it, it kind of doesn't, you still have to kind of leave the evilness in there. You have to kind of leave the, who they are. But you get a lot of blowback from people saying, why are you kind of writing about, that kind of organization or that kind of person?
Yes, I did. And for me, it was painful to have to write about these characters, these Klan members, and Hitler in a way that made them human. Because I'm Jewish, I think of the Klan and Hitler as these inhuman monsters. But as an author, I had to put that aside and write characters that were believable and humanized, even if in the smallest fashion. And I have gotten some blowback for that, but I mean, when you write something, you have to be willing to accept the blowback, and I'm proud of what I wrote. I mean, I hated writing some of the characters because they were so monstrous and horrible, and I had to get into their heads and think of why people would do this. I mean, we know people are evil, and they do bad stuff because they want to do bad stuff, but even them, they're people, and they have childhoods that shape the way they think.
Now, did you interview any members of the Klan, or was this all strictly, historical reading and, going through historical papers and things like that to kind of get an understanding of, what life was like? Because, no one alive knows what life was like back in 1871 and after the Civil War. So to kind of reconstruct that, how were you able to kind of do that?
I did a lot of research, and in 1871, when they were persecuting the Klan, and rightfully so, and they had trials, which were more of just for show, they kept court documents, and they have, transcripts and interviews, and I read a lot of them, and it was pretty disturbing to see how these Klan members were so fanatical about what they believed. There was one in Mississippi, I forget the Klan member's name, but he and a bunch of his buddies got together and hung this African-American, this black guy, and it was a guy he had grown up with. And when he hung him, lynched him, he shook his hand and said, I'll see you later. I'll see you in the afterlife. Take care.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an absurdly, it's just a baffling time when you think back about it.
Yeah, and I think that it's always one of those times where it's like a celebration of certain things, but then it's also a time where people want to forget certain areas because, things happened in them. But you don't want to say that it had to happen in order for us to kind of get to where we are today, because, that's... That's always kind of morbid to think that way, that innocent lives, so many innocent lives, of course, have to be spared during those times to have people understand that what they were doing was wrong. And so you kind of had the same thing, I guess, when you're looking and you put in there, this is a world of hatred, time travel, but then you have redemption and things like that. You have all those kind of emotions rolling around in the book.
Yeah, it was really hard to try and think of ways where you can have these horrible, horrible people and then they sort of do a 180 and redeem themselves. Like one of the main characters was a Klan member and then he changes his mind and becomes a good guy. And I mean, that stuff happens, but it's really difficult to try and process it.
So give us a little bit more insight into, two of your main characters, Jeb and Crispus. Did you when you were writing the book here, and again, we're speaking with author Lane Haymond, and the book is The Freedmen and the Pharaoh's Staff. LaneHaymond.com is the website. Did you think of kind of the chicken or the egg? Was it the story? Was it the characters? What was kind of the basis before you put, you know, the first word on the page that you created first to get the book going?
First, I had the characters, which is, I mean, in a plot-driven sort of fantasy book, it's kind of interesting because you usually think of the plot first. But I had the characters first. I had to write a short story for a class I was taking in undergrad, and they came to me, and I thought, how could I roll with this? And being a fantasy author and having fallen in love with the slave narratives and the time, I wanted to write both. So the characters came to me, and then I created a story around them.
So can you give us a little more insight then into the eyes of Jeb and, you know, Crispus, since you decide, you know, since they were kind of first, you know, if they were sitting in kind of the, you know, your living room and you're able to talk with them, you know, what kind of people are they? You know, what would you kind of ask them? You know, tell the reader a little bit, you know, in depth on, you know, on those two guys.
I actually based Jeb on Frederick Douglass, on the life narrative of Frederick Douglass, because here's this guy who suffered so much during slavery, and Jeb is a former slave, but he never lost hope. Even when he was being beaten by his master, he still fought back, and that's how I thought of Jeb. You know, he's this hardened soldier, the perfect soldier, but he's sort of gentle at heart and just wants to be left alone. All he wants to do is live a nice, normal life. Have a piece of land, come home for dinner, just be left alone. Whereas Crispus is the exact opposite, you know. He's this activist, he's sort of reckless and wild and wants to challenge everybody, wants to challenge the government, the races, but he's sort of a scared little kid and has never done anything, has never been in a fight, has never really experienced such hate himself since he grew up, you know, wealthy, grew up in a well-adjusted family for the time.
And, you know, since, you know, you wrote a couple short stories, and now this is your first novel.
Yes.
How kind of was your journey leading up and kind of getting it out there, and, you know, it's available, you know, an ebook, paperback, Nook, Kindle. How is kind of your journey leading up and getting it? Because when you go from short stories to novels, I mean, you know, you got, it's basically almost tenfold to be able to kind of wrap all that up together and get it out.
Yeah, it was difficult. The book actually started out as a short story I had to write for a class. And someone in the class, I wish I knew his name because he was sort of a jock type guy. He said, hey, I'll give you $5 if you photocopy this for me so I can read it. I was like, okay, maybe I can actually turn this into a novel. So I started writing it. You know, I was an undergrad, and it took forever. And I know you're not supposed to say that, but it did, you know, because I wanted to do all the research to make it as realistic as possible. And you have to create this long, overarching story. So I spent a lot of time. Writing it was the easy part. It was the researching and the outlining and turning a short story into a long 300-page novel. So it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I mean, and like I always say, you know, the first book is going to take you the longest to write because you kind of have your whole life to write it. Whereas now when you're kind of in your second book and you start getting a fan base and you start people wanting to start seeing more from you, that's when the pressure's on, because now you got to start writing a book. Instead of taking 3 or 4 years, you got to kind of do it in 6 to 8 months. So
exactly.
You're kind of starting to feel that kind of coming out, and you're like, now I got to kind of already get out book two. I got to kind of start, you know, getting my next one going on. You kind of feeling that pressure at all?
Yes, definitely, especially when all these professionals with the Big Six, they come out with books every year. So they're writing them like every 6 months. And that's
right.
Just the way you have to do it now. And it is a lot of pressure. And the hardest part is just sitting down in the chair and writing something. So, I mean, it is getting, it's the pressure's on.
Yeah. And do you think that this is going to, you know, are you going to turn something like when you were kind of writing, there's always some secondary characters that pop out of the book that you had no idea that maybe they would be this profound, even when going back and reading it or hearing, you know, fans kind of contact you and say, wow, you know, Sam over there, I had no, you know, that is my favorite character. And you're like, really? I mean, how did that turn out? So did you kind of have that character that kind of came out and maybe thinking, you know, you want to maybe explore them further in your work when you continue on?
Yes, there was the character Fallon, who was a Klan member, and then he becomes a good guy. And I want to explore him more because I made him in the book. He's Jewish, and he's 16, and it's just an interesting, I think, story. And recently I saw somewhere in a news article that the head of some Aryan Nazi group in America came out and he's Jewish. I think it's just because life is stranger than fiction, and I would like to explore him more. But one of the characters that most popped out was, for me, the worst character was this character, Nars, who is just a violent, racist ogre, and I hated that I loved writing him. I mean, he's a horrible monster. There's nothing good about him, but it was entertaining trying to make this horrible monster into something that's human.
Yeah, I mean, I think every author has to kind of explore their dark side, and, you know, you always have to write about things that are uncomfortable with. But sometimes that's the best writing that comes out, when you feel the most uncomfortable writing about them, because you still have to make them believable.
Exactly. And it was really hard writing him, but he was the most fun to write.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, it's like I always say, horrors I always thought was the most fun genre to write because it has absolutely no rules. There's no rules in horror. You can do whatever you want. And so when you write a character that's diabolical and things like that, it's kind of, the rules are out the window. You don't have to worry about, you know, emotion and how they interact with people or this and that. And they can kind of do whatever they want. That's their whole nature.
Exactly.
So what do you kind of got the future going on now that, you know, now that you finally got out the book, you know, The Freedman and the Pharaoh Staff, and, you know, what does the future hold? I mean, how are you liking this world that you've now thrust yourself into?
I love it. I love doing the marketing. I'm writing all the time. I'm thinking of doing a sequel because I left the ending sort of open, because for me, I like not really knowing where something has gone or is going. I like that suspense. And I think that's what's great about writing, is you leave it open to the readers. So, I mean, there's a lot coming on.
So you've already kind of said that the fans are going to know that by the end of the book, they're going to be like, well, you didn't answer this question. What the heck's going on with this one? And
yes.
You might have already gotten some emails
open
on that one. Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things, that, like you said, you can kind of hold them up into the suspense and kind of do it that way. So what else, where else are you going? What else have you been, you know, promoting and going out there with?
I've done a lot of readings and guest blogs, which I've been loving. And right now I'm working on a screenplay with a writing partner from Los Angeles while working on, you know, another book. And there's just so much going on that, like, I'm going to New York May 31st to do another reading. So I'm up and about.
Yeah. And you kind of done your, you know, you had a virtual book tour kind of March 11th, April 3rd. It's a little bit different than, you know, going around to bookstores and sitting in there and talking and people, because everything is all done, you know, electronically now, and that's a little bit different. How was the tour? I mean, you know, kind of your first one, kind of going out there, how was it for you?
It was good. It was good. I liked writing a lot of the guest posts, but by the time you're done, you're kind of reaching for ideas.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was fun, though, and, you know, a lot of people appreciated it, and I got a lot of good comments and emails from people. So it was fun. I'm planning to do another one soon, hopefully.
Yeah, for the same for the book or just for writing
for
in general?
For the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's always the fun part, kind of going out there. But it's always, you know, a little bit different. Were you a little bit worried when you kind of went out there and you published? And you know, are people going to read it? Are people going to like it? Oh God, what's going on? And then you're kind of in the public spotlight and. You know, a lot of people get very nervous with that. You know, a lot of authors get nervous because they're not used to. They're used to staying behind the computer and not being out in front of everybody.
Yeah, I would be lying if I said I wasn't nervous, but I was, especially with such a sensitive topic. I was concerned that, and I've heard some people say, oh, you know, you're racist, you're emulating these horrible Klans members, and I mean, it's part of the job. You just have to roll the punches, and if people like it, they don't. If they do, great. But I mean, I know who I am, and I mean, if you go on Amazon and look at all the great literature classics, you can see people leave scathing reviews of how much they hate The Great Gatsby.
All right.
So I mean, you just have to roll the punches, I guess.
Yeah. Have you been to any conferences? Have you gone to anything like you going to like Thriller Fest or VoucherCon or anything like that to get out there?
No, but I'm planning on it this summer to go to a bunch.
Yeah. Is there one particular author?
Hmm?
Is there like one particular author that when you go to these conferences that you just want to meet and shake hands with and be like, you know, can I just talk to you for an hour to maybe pick their brain or something?
Yes, Chris Bohaljalian, I forget how to pronounce his last name, but he wrote the Skeletons at the Feast and the Sandcastle Girls. He wrote the Skeleton at the Feast is this great book that's told from the perspective of a German family during World War II fleeing the Russians. And
mm-hmm.
two of the brothers are part of the Nazi regime and they're out fighting. And at the end, you almost end up rooting for this German family that is part of the Nazi regime. It's written so well. And there's a great, you know, there is a great Jewish character in there. But it struck me as so strange that this German family is presented in such a sort of human way. You don't
right.
think of them as these Germans celebrating the death of Jews. You see them just as a family, as they are.
And so that's kind of like, you know, one of your favorite writers that you would like to, you know, maybe talk to further.
Yes, I would love to know how he did it so well, because I don't know if I did it anywhere near as well as he did it.
But that's kind of what you aspire to kind of go out and be, and that's what you know, the whole fun part of exploring yourself, being an author, is more than, like I say, it's more than just putting words on a page. It's exploring yourself as a person and letting that self out onto the page for people to kind of critique. I mean, they're critiquing you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's good that you keep blogging. You got to always keep writing and keep blogging and keep, you know, those things out there. Because, you know, if you stop, then you can kind of lose, you know, it's like basketball or baseball or football. Once you kind of stop, you kind of lose your timing. And
exactly.
And that can be hard.
Writing is a muscle. It's a skill. You have to always be writing.
Yeah. Well, Lane, I'll tell you what, you know, we want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about it and, you know, letting us, you know, giving everybody a little bit about the Freedmen and the Pharaoh staff. And keep us up to date on things that you got going on, and we'd love to talk to you again.
Beautiful. I'd love to talk again. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Lane. Enjoy yourself.
All right, you too. Thanks.
All right, thanks. Bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Lane Haymont, lanehaymont.com, H-E-Y-M-O-N-T is the website. And the book is The Freedman and the Pharaoh Staff. Very intriguing subject matter, like I said, because it's involving an era in the United States that was extremely volatile at the time, right after the Civil War when the Ku Klux Klan around. But then he also brings in the historical aspect of the Pharaoh Staff in Egypt and just kind of wraps it all together, and it makes for a very interesting read. So I suggest that you go out and check that out, especially if you're a fan of historical novels, historical mystery and thrillers, and, you know, kind of like those new twists on things that are going on. We're going to be back here with our next guest coming up. His name is James Tabor, and he just released a book, and, oh, it's not up in front of me, but I'll get it here. And he's going to be coming on here to talk about his latest book, and I'm going to have to get it because I'm a little behind on that one. And in the meantime, wait around and get a little bit of this.
I know that scam. Why do I find it hard to write the next line? Oh, I want the truth to be said. I know that much is true.
Everybody here for our last segment on Suspense Radio. Right now, James has not called into the show, so we're going to give it a little bit of time to see if he makes it on. Sometimes those things happen, and that's quite all right. What I will do then is I'm going to go ahead and check out, and there's a lot of great books that have come out and are always coming up because you have summer reads that are coming out, and so a lot of publishers will now start packing a lot of books, you know, kind of into this time for the fact of, you know, a lot of people, of course, read in the summer, and a lot of books, of course, are sold in the summer. People go on a vacation. And so some of the new releases that I see that are coming out, one great thing that I noticed is Stephen King has a book coming out, and it's called Dr. Sleep. And I'm trying to remember if he's ever done this before, so if you wanted to email me and let me know, you can let me know. But he's bringing back one of his characters that he has had in his books before, which, of course, is Danny from The Shining. And Danny is now grown up, being as how he was 12 years old back in The Shining. And now he's all grown up, and he is now the main character in this book, Dr. Sleep. I found that fascinating that King did that. I know that he kind of weaves some stuff in with the Dark Tower, but that's one that I'm really interested in seeing more of. And, of course, Stephen James, I just saw his book is coming out, The King, which is part of his Patrick Bauer series. That's always fascinating. Also this month is David Balducci comes out with The Hit, another great spy novel that he has. One book that just came out this week was Taking Eve with Iris Johansson, another great author that's been doing a lot of fabulous stuff. Stuart Woods with Unintended Consequences, another Stone Barrington novel. Lisa Scottoline with Don't Go, and she's going to be in our next issue of the book. Dan Brown comes out with Inferno, another Robert Langdon book, May 14th. Andrew Gross just had a book out called No Way Back, and he was just in April it was on April 2nd called No Way Back, Andrew Gross. Harlan Coben, of course, came back. You saw a little bit of his preview in our magazine with his book, 6 Years. What else do we got coming out here? Oh, let's see. John Sanford with Silk and Prey, another book in the Prey series, comes out May the 7th. So for fans of that, you're going to be able to see his. In fact, I got a copy of it right here. I'm looking at it. Another big thing that's starting to come out that I see is a lot of apocalyptic novels, post-apocalyptic, like what would happen on, you know, post-apocalyptic novels, things like that. And those are starting to become, I think, a lot more popular when I start to read and start to see the new releases that are coming out, is that kind of exploration of what would happen in a post-apocalyptic period and things like that. Brad Thor with Hidden Orders coming out on July the 3rd. We're going to hopefully have Brad in the magazine back on the show to talk about that. He's always a great guest. Steve Barry's book, The King's Deception, is going to be coming out shortly. I believe that's in June or maybe late May. I think they moved it back. I think it's going to be early June that his book is going to be coming out. Allison Brennan is going to have one out called Stolen. We're going to have her on the radio show. She was supposed to be on about a month or so ago, and for whatever reason, she couldn't be able to make that. So we're going to have her on for that. It's another Lucy Kincaid novel called Stolen. Catherine Coulter, of course, great author, coming out with another FBI thriller called Bombshell. We may contact her to see if we can get her back on. She's always great to listen to. And then, there's a lot of maybe authors that, maybe you've not heard of, but are getting some really good, feedback and a lot of good press. Philip Kerr, A Man Without Breath, Bernie Gunther novel. C.J. Johnson, I kind of read this one, not the book, but I kind of read the synopsis, figuring out, looks interesting, called The Black Widow is out. Jeffrey Archer, his book's coming out. We're going to have him in the magazine. We're interviewing him with his book, The Best Kept Secret, comes out April 30th. Great author, of course, Lisa Jackson, comes out July the 30th. Going to try to have her on to speak about her book, Ready to Die, Selena Alvarez, Reagan Pascoli novel, and that comes out July the 30th. Mary Higgins Clark has a couple books coming out. Karen Slaughter has one coming out, another Will Trent book called Unseen, July the 2nd. Stephen King has another one coming out called Joyland, June the 4th. That should be interesting. Janet Ivanovich has one coming out called The Heist. She wrote this with Lee Goldberg. Not real sure. Not too much about that. I haven't heard too much about that one. So it's not going to be a Stephanie Plum book. Again, Dr. Sleep is September 24th. I've been emailing frantically over to Stephen King's publicist and people. I swear I got to get him on this freaking show. I'm going to do everything I can to try to do it, even if it's for 10 damn minutes, just to be able to hear him on the radio, to have you guys be able to listen to him would be fascinating. So I'm going to push for this Dr. Sleep book because I think the premise is awesome, and that comes out September 24th. Joshua Graham is back with Beyond Justice on April the 8th. And he's going to be in the magazine. He was just in the magazine, actually, on April, talking about his book coming out. Jeffrey Deaver with another Lincoln Rhyme book called The Kill Room comes out June the 4th. So if you don't have enough to read, then you're just really not paying enough attention is the way that I view it. Take a drink here. Because there's so many great books coming out with so many great authors that they kind of you're going to need to pack your Kindle or your Nook to with anything that you kind of want because there is so much stuff coming out. I'll give you a little preview. Like I said, I wrote a letter from the editor that's going in the May book, in the May issue of the magazine, and it has to do with reviews. And I said, reader, beware of reviews. I want you, if you go on and you even look at some of the big authors, like Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Kirkus, places like that, just go out there, read the guidelines. Read submissions of books. Read how you have to do it and look at some of the things. Something that might surprise you. I will say that there's a couple places that, you're spending $400 or $500 to get your book reviewed. If you're an author and you're paying to get your book reviewed, you're being scammed. Do not, under any circumstances, pay to get your book reviewed. The reason why I say that is two things. First of all, you'd never want to get a false sense of security because if you're going to pay $500 to get your book reviewed, and it better come back as a good review. Otherwise, you've wasted $500 because, well, you're not going to put it anywhere. And if it is a good review, and it better be a good review, is it a true determination of what the book actually is? You need to find places that have unbiased opinions, places that, stop with these, not have Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Kirkus. I could care less. I'm in the business. I do care less what a review from one of those places say on a book that I'm going to pick up, or when people email me and say, Publishers Weekly said this was a 5-star review and this and that, that does not get me to get them on the show. I do research on who they are, on what their subject matter is, and on what they're writing, and I check out their site. I check out to see what's on their site. How are they writing on their site? To see whether or not the book is going to be good. That's all we got to go on. Because, like I said, readers, you got to beware of these reviews. Word of mouth is still one of the best ways, without a doubt, to do it. I mean, with all the sock puppeting going on there, with the Amazons and the Barnes & Nobles, you just don't know who is going to write that. Is it the author writing it? Is it a friend of his writing it? Is he making it? Are they putting a bad review on somebody else? You just don't know. You have to be very, very careful. You know, do research, ask friends, get involved in book clubs, get involved with people that are reading the same genre as you are, so you can make better estimated hypotheses, guesses on which book that you want to read. I don't think James is going to make it on the show today. His book is called Frozen Solid. JamesNTabor.com, T-A-B-O-R. Fabulous author. We'd love to have him, get him on. Maybe something happened and we'll have to just reconnect with him later. But I'm going to go ahead and the show early here, but what I'm going to do is I want to thank all of the authors that came on. Gail Lukasik with her book, The Lost Artist. Then we had also on here was Mary Jones talking about her book, The Trouble with Charlie, and we just spoke with Lane Hamant and his book, The Freedmen of Pharaoh's Staff. To check out all this stuff, go ahead and check us out on suspensemagazine.com. Get everything up to date on what you're doing. Email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. Get the magazine, a couple of 4 free issues for free, sent right to you. Check it out. It's all electronic. You can read it on any device you got. We have some great books out there. Matthew, we also publish. M. William Phelps, the author of Dark Minds, Star of Dark Minds, his book, The Dead Soul, is out. We published that book, republished it, re-released it out there. Amy Lignore with her book 13 is out. Sarina with her book The Other Side is out. Joseph Vidal with The Shell Game is coming out. We got some great reads that we filter through that we publish and put out there for people on electronic versions, digital. And some of them are available in paperback if you'd like to do that too. To be able to go out and read, because we do a lot of filtering on those authors too. So check out our reads. I'm going to give you a little shameless plug here. So I want to thank everybody again for the show, and we will see you all here in a couple weeks. The show in the future is going to be a little bit off because June I'm going to be off for a couple weeks taking my 20-year-old daughter who just got married out to her husband who's in the military in Fort Bragg where she's going to be living in North Carolina. So that is a little scary. And then we're going to be in the ITW coming out on July, so we're going to be gone for a couple weeks there, taking a little vacation, going out to the ITW. So keep checking the site. Our next show is going to be May 4th with Michael Stanley, Ted Camasto, or Camasta, Richard Mabry, and Devi Big Googe. These authors really have to get better last names that I can pronounce. And so that's going to be in 2 weeks. And then, like I said, just keep checking the schedule. We're going to start adding more and more things. We're so happy that we're involved here with Partners in Crime Tours to be able to talk with their authors. We're going to start a brand new show on Sunday called Suspense Radio One-on-One, where you're going to hear those authors that are on tour currently from Partners in Crime and to check out anything that they have going on. Just simply go to PartnersInCrimeTours.net to see what they have. If you're an author, you want to check them out because they do some really great services to get you out there with your book. So in the meantime, everybody, we are going to talk with you later, and thank you so much for joining us today on the show, Suspense Radio. And again, we're going to try to catch up with James Tabor at some time in the future. We're so sorry we weren't able to get on, but thanks so much for coming on. See y'all later. Bye.